Revenue is open. Good morning, committee. Believe it or not, we're going to start off today with central assessment. And I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 571 and Senate Bill 611. I want to today go to the PUC and to the Department of Revenue first. Kyle has a presentation on a follow-up, I think was started in a discussion with Senator Riley on some revenue forecasts, some charting.
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. On OLIS, there is under 611 in the meeting materials, I do have a document titled Revenue Example 611-1, and this was in response, Senator Riley, you asked yesterday about a chart that had been presented previously under some of the other draft language. So I included that at the top of the example there that really it shows the essentially assessed that's currently being imposed. It also has a column for the deferred billing credits. So the sum of those two would be the dollars that would come in if deferred billing credits were being, if they were actively being collected. And then the figure on the far right is the two would be $271.3 million. So that's the total amount minus the 7.5 million revenue impact that was displayed yesterday. But it gives it a little more context than this.
Yeah, I see that chart. Thank you very much.
Okay. Brian Conway from the PUC is here. We're looking at the Dash 1 amendment to 611, and one of the newer dynamics in this bill is what we were affectionately calling the super information highway, and the certification for that higher broadband speed would be issued by your agency, sir. And we thought we'd check with you to make sure that was okay.
Sure. Well, thanks, members of the committee, Chairman Haas. My name is Brian Conway with the Oregon Public Utility Commission. I'm an administrator of the division in charge of telecommunications and water industries. I thought I'd start with a caveat, which is that the commission hasn't yet had an opportunity to hear this bill and take a position. They do that in a public meeting. And so I won't be able to speak to a position on the bill today. I did read this. Actually, I became more aware of it on, I guess, late Friday afternoon, Monday morning. So it's a bit new. So I have some of my comments may seem naive, but I thought I'd go through what I'm looking at. And I focus primarily on that superhighway piece, which is, I believe, Section 3. Mm-hmm. And so the short summary is that, yes, I believe the PUC has the expertise and the wherewithal to do the certification that you're asking for. I did have a few questions, and I did listen in on yesterday's hearing, so I heard there were some concerns as to whether or not this was, in essence, some a backdoor regulation of broadband or anything like that, so I figured I'd address that point, which is that yeah, I think with some minor language change in here, you would not have that issue. If that is the case, that you wrote a law that regulated the broadband, I think we've been preempted by federal law, so I don't think it would last long. Okay. So along those lines, in Section 3B, where you're talking about the you say that you want to make sure that the cost of the service is no more than 150% of the average. The way I read this is that you're referring to it more commonly as the price of the service. If you were to get into the cost of the service, that would start looking a lot more like regulation. Are we building up? Are we loading labor? Are we doing this types of thing? And so if it is the case you're looking at price, if you make it price, that's not regulation. That's looking out at what the market prices are setting and using that as our benchmark as opposed to regulating and building up and requiring a lot of accounting information. And then in Section 3C, you have a requirement that they provide more than 50% or they provide it to 50% or more of the customer base in the market. If you change that to a service territory or something like that, I think you can avoid a lot of controversy over what's the appropriate market. So people could argue that the market is Oregon or nationwide. There's a lot of different ways of looking at the market for broadband, but if you define a specific geographic area or allow the company that's coming in to define a specific geographic area and say that's where we're going, and then you say 50% of that. That's a very easy question. And so it's a statement, but it's also a question, so I can help decide how much, if at all, you know, this would add to the workload of the PUC as far as cost in that. If you're talking about a more of a competition study in markets, that's a bit more than say somebody decided to serve the Portland area or something like that, and they defined it by county or by city limits or something. That's more direct, a lot easier to measure. The only other thing I thought I'd bring up is I heard a question yesterday about whether or not the standard was state of art, and I'm new enough to this, I don't know, but in Section 3B, you're referring to a gigabyte per second of service, and I thought I'd just point out for whoever it was that asked yesterday if this is state of the art, that I don't believe there's anybody in Oregon right now providing gigabyte service. Yeah. And typically internet speeds are measured in gigabits, and there's eight bits to a byte. So what this is describing is eight times faster than the Google Fiber in Kansas City and the gigabit service provided by CenturyLink. So it's just a question of, you know, if you want that for a stretch goal. I just thought I'd make sure, because there's a lot of confusion from time to time between gigabits and gigabytes, because it's not something we really talk about that much. The other one is the 45 days seems like a long time, but when we look at commission calendars and try to get them set up and make sure there's a public hearing and some discovery in that, I would say that that's a pretty good one for a very straightforward application. And so I noticed that there is no ability to extend or anything else, and so if anything got controversial or it took a little bit longer to get data, it may make sense to add the ability to extend this at some point if it needed more than 45 days, because otherwise it looks like the option is kick them to next year, which I agree gives them the incentive to give us a very clean application, so that part would be great. It's just whether or not you want to provide a little bit of wiggle room in case there's just a couple of weeks that we need to get some additional information. And then along those lines, I guess the only other part I was told was to discuss administration issues or how to ease the administrative burden, I guess. And one of the suggestions I would have would be to have legislative council work on this to ensure that Department of Revenue can freely share some of the information that you want in the legislative report that is in I may not be able to pull the section. It's towards the back, but you have a legislative report where the PUC reports on the projects that were certified, how much tax breaks they got, who they're serving, how they're serving them. And so it would be really helpful if there was some enabling language that made it clear to Department of Revenue, hey, this may be confidential, but you can share it for purposes of this report with the PUC, so that we're not asking the company and then trying to gauge whether it's accurate with Department of Revenue. So those are, you know, I believe those are the questions I heard yesterday that I thought would be helpful and what I was told today. With that, I was taking a guess at what you might want to know, so I'm happy to answer any questions.
You did a great job. Thank you. Those are very helpful comments. Appreciate your cooperation in this and your reassurance that you don't want to be regulating internet. You're just going to be certifying, and that's certainly our intent, Senator Boquist.
Just a follow-up to the same comment you just made, Mr. Chair, just to ensure I understand. It's obviously my intent. It's certification. That's the discussion we have. And you're saying if in Section 3 we take out cost and put in price, and in Section 3C if we replace market with service territory, that gives us a reasonable comfort in this, that this is actually certification and not regulation. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. I would, as long as we're not setting the service territory, you know, we do that for our regulated companies. And so, but yeah, I think that would go a long way to appeasing concern that we're actually de facto regulating the internet and setting the price of broadband, which I don't read you wanting to do in this at all.
Well, clearly not my intent to regulate, Mr. Chair. One follow-up, Mr. Chair. And then we went out in the farther out in Section 4A, 45-day window. Are you suggesting something in, you know, like mutually agreed, you know, some that sort of language there is where the PUC and the entity are close. I mean, how do you think that wording would be in which to buy another couple of weeks if it looks like it's close versus, okay, one side or the other stalling?
I think the Chairman Haas and Senator Boqvist, I think that the language you just described about mutual agreement would make some sense that way. It generally works well in the sense that if companies want an answer faster than the commission can get it, they can always default to no. So I think that would be the right language, and I think it covers a couple of bases. One, commissioners' calendars, you know, if they get there. I would imagine the initial stuff wouldn't involve the commissioners. It would be staff working with the company to collect the information, and hopefully with Department of Revenue to collect some of that information. And with any luck, we're working on it throughout the time period, you know, before they just get to that time they want to go for their tax break. I did forget one thing I would mention is that it may be helpful, and I would just broadly term this as ensure that the PUC has the tools to do what you're asking. And so one thing that strikes me is something that wouldn't be too onerous on the companies but makes some sense is that they at least, maybe the right word would be register with us, so we have an idea of the name of the company, where they are in Oregon, a contact person, because otherwise I don't know how we would go about finding the people who are going to ask for the tax break. But if they knew up front, hey, you need to submit this to the PUC and it has to be before April 14th, that would be great.
My guess is they would find you.
Yeah, I would hope so.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As the IT person on the committee, I should have caught bits and bytes myself. But that's one of the reasons I want possibly to change that language to state-of-the-art instead of specific, you know, gigabits and that sort of issue. What do you think about that difference?
Chair Haas, Senator Riley. It certainly provides flexibility, but sometimes that much flexibility invites controversy as to what's state-of-the-art and what's not. Mm-hmm. I notice you have a section in here where we would initiate a rulemaking after consultation with Department of Revenue, and it would probably certainly be workable if you were to provide an initial minimum threshold, and perhaps that is gigabit service. And then, through some direction, maybe allow the commission through a rulemaking to update standards should it be clear. And maybe you could tag it to the FCC comes up with a new definition of what super high-speed internet is or something like that. That may be a way of changing the threshold in the interim. It looks like it's reviewed every 5 years. I don't know if that means coming back to you or not, but... you know, something along those lines would probably work.
Thank you.
Very helpful comments. And we'll incorporate some of your suggestions into this next refinement. With no other questions, thank you.
Thank you.
The Department of Revenue is going to weigh in on the Dash 1 amendments. John Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. We have a few comments on it. We took a long look at some of the provisions that are new to us, and even as yesterday, and just in terms of how they were worded. And some of our concerns begin on page 4, line 8. We think that what's happening there is in the section lines 4 through 8 on that page. We think what's happening there is that the it appears as though the language is referring to the unit value and not the Oregon allocated value. So we just want to be clear about the intent of the committee and understanding whether or not this exemption is coming off at the unit level, which could be the worldwide value, or whether it's coming off after it's been allocated to Oregon and then we subtract the the exemption. So that's just a point of clarity that we'll be interested in finding out. Because if it's, you know, if the wording is needs to be changed to reflect your intent, we're happy to work with you on that. The second point I'd like to make is in regard to the lines 9 and 10 of the same page, which would be page 4, where it says that the real market value of the company's real and tangible personal property located in Oregon. So we're interpreting that as to mean that we have to determine that value. And that discussion goes back to earlier comments we've made all along, is that we do not separately value tangible property from intangible property of a company. We value the entire company as a unit. So to the extent that we either have to come up with a value for the intangible property or the tangible property, either one, we would have to do a separate appraisal. We'd have to actually get additional staff to do an appraisal of just the tangible property if we're going to segregate those two out. So that is something that we don't currently do. And so and if we could do this, I could tell you that we could have come up with the intangible value, because it would simply be a subtraction from the total.
Right, there's the problem.
So that has been our concern all along. This just looks at it from the other side. So we would be happy to work with Legislative Revenue Office in coming up another way to characterize that. The next point is on page 9, lines 2 through 5. And this has to do with the definition of, I believe, transmission services. We're concerned that any definition here has the potential for unwinding the decision of the Supreme Court in the Comcast case. We did provide language for this section that we think would work. It's not in here, so we would be happy to resubmit that, and that would eliminate our concerns with that section. We think it gets at what you were trying to get at in terms of email accounts and those kinds of things, but says it in a way that we think will not affect the definition that we've been working with, that we paid dearly for through the Supreme Court.
So those are, you know, there's some serious policy issues there, but assuming we're all on the same page and clarifying those, this amendment offers some fairly new dramatic changes, and I was just wondering where the comfort level is, assuming these clarifications are made from the department.
Right, and we thought we understood what the policy direction was going to be with that amendment, and that's why when we offered it language to help address that, we thought it covered it. For us, it covers it. So should you take our language and put it right there, then your policy would be carried through as we understand it. And
okay. Well, I'm talking about the overall amendment. Is that what you're referring to?
The overall.
Should we make that change, and the other one relating to dishes and the market value on the franchise fees? What is the comfort level of the department on this approach with the franchise fee exemption, the cap, and the super information highway?
Yes, and we think these are minor changes that could be made to fix it, and we don't see that. We think we're very close.
Okay.
To being comfortable.
Senator Vocals.
Mr. Phillips, just to make sure I'm clear, so that your language gets in. Page 9. Where are you talking about inserting language at?
Page 9, line 2 through 5 in the.
Got it. And that's where you want to insert to make sure that we don't unwind the court case, right?
Right, particularly striking the words providing or obtaining data transmission services and on line 4 and 5 striking the words transmission property. But I'd have to check to see the language that we submitted, but it's we think it captures this electronic mail account in that language that we understood you were trying to get at.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes.
Other questions? Okay, John.
Did you also want to get our views of the satellite language?
Yes.
Not? Okay.
We talked about this. Please.
Not in this amendment, but as a separate discussion, there's been talk about an exemption for satellites orbiting the Earth. And so we wanted to make it clear that we treat those, we view those as being tangible property, not intangible property, which is absolutely fine to the extent that you want to include them in an exemption. That can be done. We just want to be sure, like all of the other things, that we have an ability to identify the value of that and not have ongoing disputes about what the values of those satellites would be. I've seen some draft language, and we will run it by our attorneys and make sure that that's something that will work, and then we'll get back to Legislative Revenue Office about that.
Okay, and absent that, where does that, does it still leave an uncertain cloud up there, out there in outer space without some clarification?
Right, right. I mean, I think the basic concept of exempting a particular thing is just a function of whether or not we can identify it and whether there's a value that we can grab and take that's going to be consistent across companies. And just like we testified on behalf of the franchise intangible, it's, if it's something that's booked, it's something that they're going to have in their reporting for federal purposes, and we can just take that number and extract it.
Okay, good.
So that's our concern, but we think that we can get there.
Senator Burcher.
How does the, thank you, Mr. Chair. How does the federal government handle satellites? How do they identify them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burcher.
As far as property.
That is totally outside my universe of experience. And so I wouldn't care to comment on.
I don't know about the regulation or any of that kind of stuff.
Right. I don't either.
You don't either, okay.
No.
The Department of Defense targets them, that's what.
If I could make a comment regarding comments made by the PUC, we do not have the taxes or information regarding the taxation of these companies or the property. We simply value them. So we turn over the values, the appraisals annually to the county assessors. So in order to carry out your intent here, we might, and to assist the PUC, we might simply add some language that says that the counties will report to us that number of, you know, the values, not the values, but the taxes and the companies, so that we can gather that data for PUC and then turn it over.
Okay, we can do that. It's easy for us. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 571 and Senate Bill 611. And we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 254. Has it?
Did he mean to close the work session, or do you need to carry it over?
Are we carrying this
over? Are we carrying that work session over, or do
you
close it?
Yes, we are carrying 611 and 571 over till tomorrow. Thank you.
Morning, Chair, members of the committee. Bring to you Senate Bill 254. This is a bill introduced by. Maybe we can. Just because we're not taxing satellites, Mr. Chair, doesn't mean people.
I know, you would think. Sorry, don't take it personally.
They're
not walking out because of you.
We can always ask the Chinese to give us the data. I'm certain they know where these satellites are.
What are we doing here?
254.
Yeah. So 254 is on your OLS page. And 254 basically, as I mentioned, is a Department of Agriculture bill. This has to do with a fee. Increase for the fuel, motor vehicle fuel metering devices. Those motor fuel devices, metering devices are assessed a fee of $5. This bill attempts to increase that fee gradually over a number of years until 2019. To reach about $10 to cover the cost for this project or that program. Sorry, I have also included as background information in case you're interested some of the other ORSs that are mentioned in the bill. That is not necessarily in relation to the bill, but I like to do that when there is other mentioning of ORSs. that's in the other document. And Mr. Chair, we have the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture, Lisa Hansen, and Jason Berger and Stephen Harrington, also from the department, who would like to give you an overview of this program and their need for that fee to be increased.
All right, and why don't you come on up, Lisa? And the this bill has already had some deliberation. It has passed the business committee on a 3-1-1 vote.
Mr. Chair, this came from the business committee.
It came
business and transportation.
Business and transportation.
I guess historically, does this particular policy always come through revenue before? I mean, I'm just curious. In my committee, we took a fee bill that I frankly found was quite difficult to discuss without the context of the entire budget. We just sent it straight to Ways and Means, and we didn't even weigh in on it. It was a bipartisan decision to do that, but so the fact that this started in the business committee and now is in the revenue committee, and then presumably will go to Ways and Means, it seems like an odd treatment of a fee bill, and I'm wondering if there are aspects of this particular fee that I'm just not familiar with. It. Just curious. More than anything. So.
I've seen it both ways. Mazen, do you have a...
Mr. Chair, the Senator Edwards, you're correct that it is, in general, the fee bills that have to cover a certain program do go through the Ways and Means when they're connected to the program. Mm-hmm. I think the slightly different thing that seems to have happened with this fee bill is that it is not connected to an expenditure limitation. So probably somewhere in the process we've decided to that this will go through the revenue committee and to send it back to the Ways and Means probably would be a lot more complicated than just going through this process. However, there will be no expenditure limitation that comes against the increase in this revenue increase until Ways and Means actually increases the expenditure for the program. Mm-hmm. But this would be available for that.
And I see no reference to Ways and Means.
Oh, there isn't.
And that, Mr. Chair, does not necessarily have to be that the expenditure for the program, if the program to increase, will go through the Ways and Means. But this revenue would actually be there as an increase. So this would be a continuously appropriated type of revenue, and the amount to be increased for the program will come through the budget process in the Ways and Means.
Okay. Senator Burchard.
Just a clarifying question. So we're talking about the fees that are paid, the sticker on the gas pump. Is that what we're talking about?
Sure. I think if we let them explain, it'll come out, because we're losing money right now, which is why they already have the revenue expenditure. And we're losing money, I think, is the issue here. So I think if they explain it, Mr. Chair, it'll become clear as mud to everybody.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to visit with you about Senate Bill 254. For the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, the Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. This is a fee bill that deals with our motor fuel quality program. It's part of the Weights and Measures program within the department. Our motor fuel quality program really looks at assuring that motor fuel is what it's labeled. So if you're buying a certain octane, we look to see if it is that octane. We look for quality. We look to see if there's water in the motor fuel. We also respond to complaints when people have concerns about the fuel that they've purchased, that it's not performing the way that it should. This program was put in place in the late 90s. It's been around for a while. The fee has remained at $5 throughout that time frame. The actual cost of the program is actually double what we have been collecting in terms of the fee to support it. And it has been subsidized by the rest of the Weights and Measures program, the scales part of that program, which are many of the same fee payers generally. We've worked with our fee payers to come up with a plan to more fully cover the cost of the program so it can stand on its own. And that's the proposal that's before you today. It doubles the fee over the next 4 years, raising it 20% a year, which then would bring it to a place where it would cover its costs where we're at today. And then we would revisit this fee at that point in the future with our industry fee payers to determine if the services that we're providing meet their needs or if there's something additional to continue to make this program stand solely on its own. And I will pause there to see if there are any questions.
Clarify who pays this.
So this would be a fee that's paid by anyone who has motor fuel devices. So it can be a grocery store, a Safeway. It could be a gas station, Quick Stops.
So this, I remember back in a prior life when I was a news guy, we would do stories on unscrupulous gas stations that would water down their fuel and not meet the standards. But you have inspectors to go out and probably don't call them that, but that's, they make sure that they do random checks and that sort of thing. And this is the money that pays for that.
Senator Hess, you are correct.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does it apply, is it just to gasoline and diesel, or does it apply to propane, compressed natural gas, things like that?
Low carbon fuels.
Jason Barber, Department of Ag. Chair Hass, Senator Edwards. Just liquid motor fuels, so gas, diesel, and biofuels, B100, ethanol, E85. And to answer your question, the Weights and Measures Device Program, so we have 18 inspectors located across the state. There's 57,000 weighing and measuring devices in Oregon that makes up Oregon's commercial weighing system. As they are testing, for instance, F meters at the retail gas stations, the sticker that you're seeing is the certification of the actual meter, the pump. But while they're there, we leverage those 18 inspectors, and we also have them test the motor fuel that's at that retail station. So they are checking the underground storage tanks for water. They're reviewing all the bills of lading to make sure that the E10 and B2 renewable fuel standard in Oregon is being met by kind of a document review. We also have a field analyzer. It's about the size of a shoebox. It's called a Zeltec. They fill up kind of a petri dish. It uses infrared light technology, shines in the petri, reads the spectrum, and it's able to read the octane level and the ethanol and biodiesel content. It's a very useful tool. We also, when we go to the larger terminals in Portland and Eugene and testing those meters, there's about 31,000 F meters, G and H meters, the truck stops. You're going to see the higher output meters, G meters, and then the terminals and distributors are probably going to be G and H meters. But 28,000 out of the 31 are the F meters at the local gas stations. So those meters are assessed an additional $5 each year to fund the motor fuel quality program.
It seems like a lot of ground to cover for 18 guys, but I guess you do it. Is it, can you, you do it on a random basis, and when you find someone whose gas tanks fall below, what's the course of action?
Yeah, they have home offices, so they're located all across the state. They each have a geographical region that they're responsible for. That can, you know, the Portland area, they could have as much as 4,000 devices. Eastern Oregon, because they have more drive time, it could be 2,500 devices. We try to inspect those devices once a year. We're consistently right in the 96 to 94% each year. Mm-hmm. We also get about 80 complaints, customer complaints for motor fuel quality per year. We try to address those as quick as possible. We take about 100 to 120 actual lab samples of fuel, send those to a private lab in Vancouver, Washington, inspectorate, and kind of run a battery of tests. not sure if I answered your question, but that's.
Senator Boquist.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, we've actually seen this in revenue a couple times before, because the Ways and Means has been giving them expenditure limitations above what the revenue is coming in fee for service, which is why we're in a catch up and why the bill comes to revenue. Several times we've done this, unfortunately, with the Department of Agriculture. And really, the intent here, you know, Mr. Chair, is, I mean, they do get inspected. You see a little sticker on the machine that's right there that says you're buying a gallon and getting a gallon, and it's really what they say it is. But I'm just curious if we know when we get to 2019, are we going to break even, or are we still going to be in arrears?
Chair Haas, Senator Boquist, we've it really has over the last probably 3 years has seemed to level out at the $300,000 a year level. I think when kind of the big changes. Certainly with the Oregon's renewable fuel standard and having to check and kind of enforce that was a big load on us. But since that, the triggers have all kicked in and things have been leveling out, I feel fairly confident that we're hoping it'll level out at the 300 per year mark.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
So then hopefully in 2019, what we're really seeing is we'll be back to a fee for service, which will be a Ways and Means process versus the argument that may be that, okay, this really isn't a fee for service. This is really a reverse fee for service. We've been subsidizing it from somebody else, which is why it's sitting before this committee right now, okay, in theory. So when we get to 2019, it'll be at least within the margin of error that when you go through the Ways and Means process, another dollar or something will bring it back into the fee for service versus a taxation issue.
Senator Haas, Senator Boquist, that is exactly the hope of this.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're trying to lose less.
Senator Berger.
Right.
So I think I have it straight in my head, but I'm going to do a hypothetical on you. I own a gas station. I have one gas pump. You come in, you're gonna make sure that pump's putting out a gallon when it says it put, and you're going to check the fuel. How much is that going to cost for that one pump?
I think I have that. It's the $5 assessment for motor fuel, and then the actual device inspection license for an F meter would be 30.
I think it's 35.
Or 34. So the total is 39. Yeah.
To do that, because. Yeah. So you said you've been subsidizing this through weights and measures. So if we go with the $5 for this. Where is that extra money going to flow back to that you're no longer subsidizing?
Yep.
Senator Haas, Senator Bartschuker, that's a good question. It would then be in that weights and measures fund, and what it allows us to do is to continue longer at the current fee schedule for those F meters before we have to increase the fees again.
Okay. And I stand corrected, it's 32 plus 5. For a total of 37.
So you're in good shape. So you didn't know that you were going to face a gas station owner up here. Other questions? Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do think it's a good idea that we rebalance, so to speak, so that this program is carrying its own weight. Sounds like it was being subsidized by the larger Weights and Measures program, which was that one of them that was swept in 2009? Was it? Do you remember? I believe it was. Which is a whole other topic.
I see nods.
I think it was. Senator Haas, Senator Edwards, I need to go back and double check, but you are remembering correctly. In 2009, there were several funds within the Department of Agriculture that had fund sweeps.
Yeah.
And I can go back and find out specifically if you would like me to bring that back to you.
No, it's really a philosophical point that I wanted to make. I don't need the details. I'm pretty sure that it was. I'm pretty sure that it was one that was swept. And I've been on Ways and Means for a number of years now, and I'm thankfully not there anymore. But I just wanted to. I bring this up whenever I have the opportunity to get on the soapbox. When we sweep funds, the fee payers who pay those fees don't feel particularly excited about coming in and supporting fee increases. So I know we had an economic emergency during that legislative session, but I just wanted to use this opportunity to bring it to people's attention because this was one of those funds that was swept. So
we take it.
Soapbox done.
You were one of the sweepers, if I recall, in 2009.
I also brought legislation. I didn't realize that it was happening until afterward, which is why I brought legislation the last two legislative sessions to bring an end to that. But you know, there are other people with more horsepower in this building that disagree with me.
So. No, it's a point well taken. It's one of the reasons for those higher ed restructurings, and so that we can never sweep those university funds anymore. So. We hope you've enjoyed our discussion up here.
Well, thank you for the discussion. I hope you've learned more about our program.
We have, and it was a refreshing break from the rather different, frankly, more complex issue of central assessment. So it was a nice break. So,
Mr. Chair, I do have one final question.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious in other arenas, because this was an issue previously. We brought this up to date previously once before when I was on revenue, so I remember this. And then, of course, as was testified, we had these new standards, and so I remember the discussion back then was we have to wait and see how this planes out and levels out. We're leveling out now. I'm just curious, are there other programs in the Department of Ag that we are going to have to catch up on? Is there other things we're going to see in which we intentionally made a policy decision not to do anything and wait until it leveled out?
Senator Haas, Senator Boquist, we are constantly evaluating our programs, the budget, their fund balances, and we have been working really hard to make sure each of those programs can stand on its own. I think this is kind of one of the remaining that's been out there for a while.
Thank you.
If there is no one else to discuss Senate Bill 254, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 254, and that closes out our agenda today. We are, as mentioned, going to carry over 571 and 611 for tomorrow with hopefully some new refinements. And we have no other business before us, so we will adjourn. We will adjourn. No other business before us, so